Welcome to the final session of Polarization and the Unmaking of America. Today we get to, I think, a session we've all been waiting for, faith and the politics of everyday life. Responding to polarization. Next week, the seminars will not meet, but they return for a special series of three sponsored by Westminster's Peace and Justice Team. It's called Sowing Seeds of Justice, Security for All. Hope you can join us on July 9th. And now, thanks to Eric Woodard Lehman for this series.
I think the sound system is failing. Thank you, Ron.
Okay, Sarah, I'm going to assume you're done since we don't hear you. It got a little dodgy there at the end.
I don't know what was going on with the sound.
All right. Good morning, and thank you for coming, and thanks to those of you who are coming back. Repeat performers, you get your little gold star for perfect attendance. Sarah asked me to pray before we start, and as I did last week, I'll do the prayer I've been doing with my two sons since they were wee little guys. They're now as tall as I am before they go out the door to school. So let us pray. God, give us open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. As Sarah said, our general theme has been polarization and the unmaking of America. That unmaking dynamic being represented here by the dissolving stars of the flag sort of floating off into the ether and disintegrating the flag, that symbol of the United States. We started first by trying to define and understand polarization. For those of you who are new this week, we'll circle back a wee bit to make sure we're all on the same page and up and running. Last week, we talked specifically about the dynamics of our media culture, particularly digital and social media, although as we discussed, the same dynamics are at work with traditional print and broadcast media as well. And we started last week at the end, and we'll pick up where we left off and move forward this week, with the idea of responding to polarization. Most of us can say, yep, there it is. I saw the bumper sticker, I saw the Facebook post, I heard my neighbor talking too loud on the phone on their back deck about this or about that. We're readily able to identify it. It's not hard to find because it's just about everywhere. It's a little trickier to know what to do, to know how to wade into those troubled waters without being drowned or having someone hold your head under because they don't like your particular point of view. And we'll do that today with a little more attention to some theological perspective. But let's first recap for those who haven't been here the past couple weeks and for those who might be a little foggy. So we said that most basically, polarization is not just being opposite, I'm here, you're there, but being in opposition. We're not just different. There's a kind of dislike that's attached to that difference. It's not just a contrast, but a conflict. And we further distinguished two kinds of polarization. One we readily recognize as issue polarization. You're pro, I'm con. You're for it, I'm against it. And that can be dodgy and dicey in its own right, but issue polarization oftentimes isn't as troubling or as problematic as we might first think, because you and I might be opposed on this issue over here, but we might be aligned on that issue over there. So we can have disagreements about specific localized issues. How should taxes be apportioned and paid? Do we or don't we get involved in global conflicts like Ukraine? What do we teach our children in school? Things like that. But even that kind of polarization is still fairly fluid and dynamic. Because we can, it's like a kaleidoscope, the colors rearrange and realign with it, each issue. The real trouble with polarization that we defined last time and the first time is the idea of identity polarization. So we're not just disagreeing about this or that, we're disagreeing about who we are, as Americans in particular, and whether or not all of us count as we. You know, my side are definitely the true, real Americans. Those folks over there, they're some other species of deficient Americans. So all our different axes of identities we talked about. We talked about race and ethnicity, our educational and economic status, our religious affiliation, one of the big ones, the divide between those who are religious in some form or fashion and those who are not. And then within those of us who are religious, you know, are we Christian, are we Jewish, are we Muslim? Are we mainline Protestant Christians? Are we Catholics? Are we evangelicals? So there's all these dynamics. And whereas in the past, those two, like issues, were sort of fluid and dynamic, we would find ourselves at different places on different axes, those over the past 40 or 50 years have become consolidated. Social scientists call this phenomenon stacking, so that your education and your economic identity get stacked with your religious identity, which gets stacked with your racial ethnic identity, into what they call these mega identities, which we broadly identify as conservative or traditional, liberal or progressive. And as a result of that stacking and consolidation, there's a lot less wiggle room in our ordinary lives relating to neighbors and in our public life and our political life. We're no longer interested in compromise, we're interested in winning. We treat the other side more like an enemy than an opponent, and we relate to each other more like sports teams. We just want our side to win, and we want their side to lose. That desire not just to win for ourselves, but for the other side to lose, is what political scientists call negative partisanship. So we're not just for what we're for, we're very actively against what you're for. I didn't put the slide in the deck today, but I talked about my time at Duke University and our rivalry with North Carolina, and how much we love to win as Blue Devils, but even when we don't win, we're real happy when the Tar Heels lose. That's the dynamic of negative partisanship. And we talked about how in the last two presidential election cycles, that dynamic has been very prominent, because even on the day you voted, exit polls show that people who voted for one candidate or the other still had a generally disfavorable opinion of those candidates. But at least they were our candidate, and they were going to lose. We also talked last week about how we exist and how polarization has grown through our social isolation and political isolation. We tend to have fewer and fewer what social scientists call cross-cutting relationships. Relationships with people who look different, pray different, eat different, think different, learn different, work different, and vote different. We've sort of grouped together by inertia, so most of the people around us look like us, talk like us, pray like us, eat like us, vote like us. And so the more and more isolated we get from one another, the more and more alienated. We just can't find our way to understanding those folks over there. And we talked about how one of the accelerants of all of this has been information consolidation. Whether we're talking about traditional print and broadcast media, or whether we're talking about new social media, the app du jour, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, etc., we have more and more information available to us, but because of the way our media ecosystem works, we're fed less and less of it. Because the producers of TV programs, the editors and publishers of print, and the almighty algorithm of social media knows who we are and knows what we want. And mostly we want to be patted on the head. Good boy, good girl, right on. You knew it all along. And we talked about how, particularly with broadcast media and digital media, the driving force is negative emotion. The angrier we are, the longer we spend on the platform, the more links we click through, and the more money Twitter or TikTok makes from their advertisers. The louder somebody yells on cable news, the more we're inclined to listen and be like, ooh, what are they gonna say next? What did those crazy people do today? So our media ecosystem is biased towards negative engagement, towards negative emotion. It's more important that they make us angry and engaged than that they inform us or give us good information. It's not to say that it's all nonsense and it's all hooey, but there is that dynamic, and that dynamic is nonpartisan. The left does it, the right does it, the people in the middle do it. And again, that just exacerbates this identity stacking, this negative polarization, and the alienation that comes with it. So since we ran a little short of time last week, I want to circle back to what we were talking about right at the tail end and pick up where we left off. We talked about how particularly new media, social media, oftentimes is likened to drug use, hence the hypodermic needle with the little social media icons in the chamber. Information scientist Edward Tufte told us there are only two industries that refer to their consumers as users: drug dealers and social media companies. But taking this more seriously, we were reminded of a pair of biblical exhortations. This is where our theological perspective begins to kick in. We're reminded that in Romans 12, we're told not to be conformed to the world, but to be transformed by renewing our minds. Likewise, we're told in Corinthians to take every thought captive and make it obedient to Christ. So there's an injunction in Scripture for us to be actively engaged with our times, with what's going on in the streets, on the telly, in the newspaper, and so on and so forth, and not just take it in passively, but to be reflective, to be discerning, and to try to sort out what's what, and to begin together as communities of faith to imagine what our place is in all of whatever it is that's going on. And we mentioned a few ways that we might do this work of taking thoughts captive and attempting to transform our minds. The first one that we mentioned is simply to unplug, at least from time to time. Delete, disconnect, turn the buzz box off. I mentioned that in another area of my academic work, I do a lot of comparative and cooperative work with Jewish theologians, philosophers, and ethicists, and a number of them are very observant Sabbatarians. So on Friday at sundown, all the devices go off, oftentimes they go in a drawer, and they don't come back out until sundown on Saturday. And I said, while I admire that practice greatly, it's not one I've been terribly successful with in my own life. So I'm recommending it to us all, including myself. My wife, who's a Presbyterian minister, often tells me that the preacher preaches the sermon that she needs to hear herself. I think it's the same that the teacher teaches the lesson that they need to learn themselves. But from time to time, whether it's once a week or part of, say, a Lenten observance, just take a step back, turn down the dial, get a little bit of space from all that noise. Another thing we said is, particularly with media that are driven by algorithms, curate. So don't just take the feed that Twitter or Facebook or whoever wants to feed you, but start to use features like lists. Select who you want to hear from, not just what's hot now. And if you have the charity and courage, start selecting viewpoints and voices with which you know you don't agree. Take some time to turn the channel to the other broadcast, whether the other broadcast is CNN or the other broadcast is Fox. Listen to different voices. As we said, one of the great things about our contemporary moment, about the technological marvel that is our world, is we can have access to just about anything. But because of the way markets and incentives work, we're funneled into smaller and smaller corners of everything. So if we can open that up, if we can break that funnel, and just for a moment, once a week, 30 minutes a day. I don't know what your media diets are. Mine's a little different because I do this for a living. You know, part of my job is to pay attention to what's going on. But, you know, switch over. Try to listen, and as much as you can, try to listen sympathetically. charitably, with a measure of an open mind to what folks on the other side of the aisle or the other side of the tracks, so to speak, are on about and why. Likewise, unfollow. So if you follow people on social media, they go, oh, you like this. And so you'll get more and more of it. That's that echo chamber, that mirroring function. You can use other ways of getting access to the same. So my primary social media is Twitter. So if I follow you, the algorithm knows that I like you and will give me more of you and more like you. Whereas if I just put you in a list without following you, it doesn't track that. So I can say, these are the people I want to listen to without feeding the monster of the algorithm. If all that is a little too technical or troublesome, I said one place to start is in a website called realpolitics.com, and it's an aggregator. So it will give you the days, the weeks, the months' news, but will cross the ideological and political spectrum. It will do a lot of the work for you. They do provide some of their own opinion and commentary, but it's mostly a, hey, here's what these people are saying about today's events in Ukraine and Russia. Here's what those people are saying. So it's a pretty easy, quick and dirty one-stop shop to try to open up that media ecosystem, try to bust out of that echo chamber and funhouse of mirrors. But taking the time to take stock of our information inputs and perhaps to restock what we're engaging is a good way to overcome what snotty philosophers like me call the straw man fallacy. Does anyone know what the straw man fallacy is or what a straw man is? I know you told me you studied philosophy. You want to help us out? Nope, that's a very good definition. So the idea of a straw man is a weak and caricatured version of whatever the opposite viewpoint is. It's what professors like me hate almost more than anything. So when students write term papers for me, which is one of the things they do by way of assessment, one of the things that I always ask and insist that they do is consider objections. So say I'm teaching my class on just war and pacifism in the Christian traditions. If you're just war, great. Tell me what just war is and why you find it compelling. But for part of your paper, tell me what the person on the other side would say. What's the pacifist counterpoint, or vice versa? And take a moment to think about how you would respond. Give them the chance to have a hearing and take a step back and rethink your own position for a minute. So the sure signs of a straw man are epithets and name-calling. All Republicans are fascist, all Democrats are socialists. Soundbites and hashtags. So in other words, a lot of what we get in our media ecosystem these days is probably approaching the problem of the straw man. What these signs reveal and what they mean is that instead of taking things seriously, instead of taking ourselves seriously, instead of taking those with whom we disagree seriously, we resort to reductive and simplistic caricatures of them, whoever they might be. We engage in truncated and cropped images. We're not interested in the wider context, the longer story. We just zoom in on the little bit of the picture that, again, confirms what we already tend to think. Straw men are exaggerated and distorted. So you take the worst features and make them magnified. If there be virtue or strength, you sort of diminish it and crop it out of the picture. And we tend to be presumptuous and dismissive. See? I told you they were like that. And thus, we wind up being irresponsible and uncharitable, which I think is a problem as a matter of ordinary neighborly decency, and it's surely a problem in terms of Christian witness. We're meant to be responsible. We're meant to be charitable. So above all else, the best thing we can do to decelerate polarization, our topic from last week, and to begin to respond to polarization, our topic this week, is to move from mediated caricatures, in this case on the slide, Facebook, and try to move back towards face-to-face engagement and interaction with real people. People who are three-dimensional, not straw men, not straw women, who can speak for themselves in their own voice, and with whom we can speak and have conversation and dialogue. That's hard to do. It's easy to say, as I just did, but it's hard to do. So a question I want to spend a few moments discussing just now is, in your own lives, individually, collectively, as the community of faith called Westminster, do you feel like you have a fair range of face-to-face interactions with folks who think differently, pray differently, eat differently, vote differently? Or do you feel like you more resemble the stacked, isolated, and possibly alienated picture of society? I'm getting a strong nod. Bruce, do we have the microphone for people on Zoom to hear?
Yes.
Yeah, I think she knows. Strong nod from the left side of the pew.
Yeah, I think I was going to say the whole South Hills community, but that's not true. But the area that we live in is very stacked, and we don't have people of differences beyond a certain area. And that goes way back to things like redlining.
Mm-hmm. Good. So our neighborhood infrastructure, through some series of events, sometimes constrained by the necessity of economics, sometimes empowered by the liberty of just where do you want to be, we all live someplace. And that sets a certain parameters around the kinds of people we're going to bump into day to day. Other thoughts about whether or not, we're going to need that microphone again, so it's Phil Donahue time. Well, Oprah time then.
In a sense, we're all one. We're all humans.
Yes.
Every human, no matter what they think, they love, they hate, they feel pain, they feel hunger, they see, and they sometimes see beautiful things and things that are not so beautiful. So we have everything in common. I mean, a lot of things in common, but we think differently. So if there's somebody that thinks differently from me, I can still connect with them on a human level. Mm-hmm. And communicate about things that we have in common. I think that's a big thing.
And if I can follow up before you hand that back, how do you cut through the many things that would divide and diverge to those commonalities?
Well, I think of what would Jesus think if he was talking to this person and this person had some crazy idea, how would Jesus treat him? Would he say, well, you're nuts? Or would he somehow find a way of expressing love for this person and at least listening to what they have to say and not just putting a cross through them and say, I'm never going to have anything to do with you again. Maybe connect on a human level and communicate. Okay. Agree that you're worthwhile. You're a worthwhile person.
Other thoughts or experiences over here on this side? Thanks.
I find that there are people with different opinions from mine, and I stumble on them and make mistakes often with it. Just a month or so ago, I said something about the abortion changes, and I got a reaction from somebody who was obviously on the other side, although I didn't really think I was expressing one side or the other. I just said this is an issue that came quite suddenly as far as I was concerned. A number of years back, I put my foot in my mouth when talking about a book that was against the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And there was a family who was very pro-military. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, those arguments stopped immediately before they really got started, but I couldn't talk about that issue after that. So
you sort of had the screeching record moment,
yeah.
You know, where you thought you were expressing something that was either widely shared or at least shared in the room you were in, and in your experience, there was no way to sort of, other than to, you know, move on to a less
touchy subject. I think to be polite, mm-hmm. I learned to avoid the touchy issues.
Yeah.
So we have maybe more shallow dialogue than we could, and we should in this environment.
Good. I think that's an important way. You can hand the microphone for your neighbor, and I will talk for a moment in the transition. I think that is an important experience, and I hope that everyone heard that, and I'm guessing we all have anecdotes of that same narrative structure. I thought I was saying something perfectly sensible and uncontroversial, and all of a sudden, with either greater or lesser discomfort and vehemence, someone in my hearing let me know that, no, I am not of that mind, I'm not of that opinion. And I think, yes, our instinct is to be polite, and I think that's a good instinct, that's part of being neighborly. You know, there are things you don't talk about in polite company, and we tend to know what they are. But I think one of the things we need to figure out in this historical moment, particularly as communities of faith and in communities of faith, is how to create spaces where that moment is welcomed. It was awkward at the coffee shop because we were just having a chat after playing tennis, but on Thursday we're having some kind of a meeting. We're having some kind of a class, we're having some kind of a seminar, and our purpose is to surface those kinds of perhaps awkward and ungainly disagreements, and then to try, with help from pastors, teachers, community, you know, leaders, to navigate that record screech moment, to figure out metaphorically, you know, how to pick up the needle and get it back in the groove and keep the song, or in this case, the conversation going. Yeah, another thought along those lines.
Well, things have become so polarized deliberately, and it feels like there are those who made certain this has happened and continues to happen. Mm-hmm. And consequently, you almost feel like you're trying to subtly figure out who might agree with where I stand on these things. And mm-hmm. and I think we tend to say less and less, because we're any topic
sure.
puts you on one side or the other these days. So I'm feeling sometimes like the tendency is just be quiet, don't say anything.
Sure. I think that's 100% one of the cultural and social effects of all this. So again, in our ordinary everyday lives, and we can bring the microphone down here and then back across while I'm chatting, I think in our ordinary everyday lives, that's probably a sane and sensible instinct. It's a kind of neighborly decency and charity. You know, my relationship with you, coworker, my relationship with you, over the fence neighbor, my relationship with you, fellow member of faith community, is more important than my opinion or view on this. So I'll step back a little, I'll tamp it down a bit for the sake of maintaining that relationship. But again, I think we do need to find, and in fact, probably need to create spaces where, you know, sort of like, you know, at the pool, there's a lifeguard on duty. You know, so we need a place where there are lifeguards on duty, pastors, teachers, community leaders, that make it safe to say, hey, you know what? Here's what I really think. And I'm curious, sincerely and authentically and genuinely curious, about what you think. And the purpose of this is not to necessarily battle it out so we both agree or somebody wins, but the purpose is to understand and to make it safe and less scary and awkward to realize that we might disagree.
Yeah, I think we all grew up learning that talking about religion or politics
yep.
was a no-no.
Yep. Religion, and politics, and money, you're not supposed to talk about them.
Well, okay, and then the three of them sort of come together. But the problem is that religion and politics nowadays, there are issues of faith that come up in the politics. There are morality issues. If we want to talk about abortion, if we want to talk about should we renew the child tax credit that feeds hungry kids, all of those things relate to, I mean, we can find scripture that tells us some things about that. So I think part of the problem is what I have learned to call the doorway conversation, where somebody stands in the doorway and makes a comment, and then they sort of disappear, and there's no way to keep that going. And somebody told me once that they belonged to a group where you had to sit knee to knee and agree to stay for 5 minutes and have some kind of combination or conversation, rather than just, you know, blasting out your thing and running away. And I don't know, I think we struggle with how to do this, because these issues are things that we care deeply about, and a person of the opposite point of view cares as well. So somehow we have to be able to hear one another. And I mean, I would want to say, well, I can't imagine why you would think that, but that's probably not, or the other thing is the trouble with you is, I mean, that's even worse. So, but you would have to get beyond that. So it's hard work, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. I like that knee to knee, whether it's a literal, you know, two chairs facing each other knee to knee, but yeah, I mean, part of what we're talking about, is going to be doing things that are artificial and contrived because we've lost them in our normal commerce of everyday life. So my 12-year-old son plays soccer. I'm the assistant coach for his soccer team. So one of the ways I think about this is through things I've learned about coaching. So soccer is played on a big, big pitch with 11-on-11 players. You don't run every practice as 60 minutes of 11-on-11 full field scrimmage. You create weird, awkward, contrived things to make the players practice particular either technical skills, how their bodies move and interact with the ball, or tactical skills, how they move in space. So you put up cones and you're like, you only have a 20 by 20 area. You don't get the full 120 by 100. And you have to play in this small space, and what that makes the player do is dribble less and pass more. Because with too many people in too small a space, you can't get through. If you try to dribble, the other team will take the ball. So you have to play short, quick passes. That's artificial. It's made up. There's no real scenario in a soccer game where you're only going to play in 20 by 20. But I think on analogy or the metaphor, we need social, political, religious spaces that are constrained in those kinds of ways, that help us practice those kinds of difficult conversations, that give us opportunities to grow and improve. And of course, growth and improvement, learning always depend on failure. The spaces have to be safe enough that things can go badly without becoming catastrophic. So again, switching back to my other metaphor, you need a lifeguard. Whether it's a pastor, a teacher, a community leader, someone who can step in if it's getting to that tipping point of being yelling and shouting and destructive rather than informing, understanding, constructive. And it's tricky, but it's possible.
I found that things are even weirder than what's going across, you know, the atmosphere was blowing across the country, so to speak. I found that with two very dear friends, one of them's 20-year-old friendship, one of them's 10-year-old friendship, that instead of listening to what I'm saying, they listen to the topical sentence and cut it off, stop. And it's like, well, we used to talk about very personal things. Why on earth? And I'll give you an example, because I was so bewildering, I felt like shaking my head. I wanted to say, I heard something on TV, and I mentioned it was on the Today Show. And instead of listening to the sentence, she heard the word Today Show. Oh, I don't listen to that anymore. And I'm thinking, okay, that's your business, but what I'm talking about is the subject. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? And I found with the other friend, bring up a subject, and it might be that, I mean, I, in my friendships, we talk about a subject like going around a bush 10 times before we decide what is the nooks and crannies and the importance of the feelings, and try to, you know, long discussions several times. But just to say, I have this thought about dismissive. Mm-hmm. And I, for my whole lifetime of friendships, I've never had people be so strict about what they will listen to or not. Mm-hmm. Not even talking about discussion.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Just listening, yeah. No, I think that's a not uncommon experience, and maybe they're doing what we heard on this side of the room a moment ago. It may come across as snippy or dismissive, but maybe that's a defense mechanism. They're like, I don't want to go there because this could get ugly, you know.
These are dear friends.
Okay.
It's just a different tone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Last one before we move on.
I'm going to piggyback on what Bobby said and what you said. I have two friends, two of my best friends. These are really exceptional people, outstanding people. But one of them will not have anything to do with the other because the other supports Trump. He's totally written him off. And I think
stuck in the middle?
Yeah. And so I think he's losing out because that's not all there is about.
Sure.
You know, and I try to, my trying to fix this, you know, I'm a fixer, is to say, well, you know, tell him some of the good things about that person that he's missing out on sharing. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's going to work.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting symptom of the problem where the differing political viewpoint or voter registration card or voter ballot from the previous election, pardon the pun, trumps all the ordinary things, whether it's, you know, golf and tennis or gardening and birding or whatever other parts of ordinary human life you three would otherwise share. It's like, nope, that one has become so important and decisive that it just clears the decks of everything else. And that's hard, particularly when you're trying to be a good friend to both parties.
The person who does that is losing out on something that could be really very good communication with other people.
Yeah, our lives are impoverished by these kinds of dynamics beyond just the social and political dimensions.
I agree. I'm feeling a sense of grief.
Yeah, that's a great word, grief. So to put it as plainly as possible, the forces of polarization, social, political, cultural, and technological, have us caught up in currents of isolation and alienation and trapped in riptides of resentment and recrimination. Like this New Yorker cartoon here, the natural flow of everyday life tends to channel us like a fork in the Three Rivers. So we need to swim against the tide, but not like the red-shirted Mohawk guy here so desperate to get back to his side, or the blue bowl-cut guy here who's trying to gently get back to his side. Swimming against the tide means not trying to get back to the safe space of agreement, the safe space of I know we're on the same page. We need to be less like these rank and file donkeys and elephants, lined up in lockstep, facing down their opponents, and more like the several wandering animals in this political illustration that are drifting from their side to the other, or perhaps hanging out somewhere in the middle with people who might not be identically minded. Like Jesus going through Samaria, rather than going around like most would, like Jesus healing the centurion's son or servant, depending on which gospel you're reading. That is the child or servant of the occupying enemy. And like Jesus always hosting the unclean at table, we need to move in that sort of direction. And we can do a lot of theological reflection, but it doesn't really get much more complicated than the silly slogan on the billboard. Hey, that love thy neighbor thing? I'm pretty serious about that, says God. So building and rebuilding these kinds of connections and relationships, creating or recreating whatever kinds of spaces we need to be able to support the awkwardness, the fear, the grief of difference, that's some of the work that religious communities can do, that can become communities of courage. You can start talking amongst yourselves. You know, my guess is churches tend to be largely like-minded, but you're not all brainwashed, identical automatons. So start talking to each other in-house. Build up some muscle memory of what that's like and what that takes, and then begin to imagine how this community can host those kinds of conversations for the wider community.
I know what you're saying.
But
that is such a small little effort. I mean, it's a huge effort for individuals. Mm-hmm. But it is carried on in an individual way. And that just seems to be like David and Goliath. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you just seem defeated already when you talk about the power of this media, mm-hmm, and the internet training you to think this way, training you to respond to negativity and be negative yourself. I suppose this doesn't sound very good coming from who I am, but it just seems like it's a lost cause.
Mm-hmm. Good. I should have put slides in the deck to respond to that.
Yeah. Say something.
Yeah. Okay.
I think we might talk about listening.
Yeah.
Someone comes to me and they're of the opposite and they're talking about Trump. Mm-hmm. I might not want to hear what they have to say, but I could listen to them and understand a little bit better where they're coming from, mm-hmm, and go from there. Then they may also listen to me in turn.
Good.
Can I say one more thing?
Certainly.
Well, I agree totally with you, Ann. I mean, I think looking at things right now, it's kind of hopeless because there are such strong forces to keep us totally dismissive and suspicious and hostile towards one another. And I keep hoping that capitalism will persevere and there will be companies that say, we are centrist. We're going to give you good information and we're going to oppose polarization. We're going to help you reunite. I keep hoping that we're going to see those kinds of things happening.
Yeah, there are market forces that can be leveraged, but let me take the question. I said, you know, one of the things I ask students to do is consider objections. Consider objections. So think back to 1950. Legal segregation in the South, de facto segregation in the North, redlining and other practices that kept us racially sorted. So, what happened in the Civil Rights Movement? How did that come off? Not rhetorical. So, 1950, separate schools, separate water fountains, separate neighborhoods, separate train cars, separate buses, separate everything. How did that go away? Because I would have to think that most of us in 1950 would have felt about that as huge, overwhelming, impossible. Yeah?
People like Rosa Parks, uh-huh, would listen.
Okay. But what's the... Go ahead.
It seemed like an individual with high intake action and some God's help.
Oh, I think definitely with God's help, but yeah. The real story of Rosa Parks goes like this. Ella Baker worked for the NAACP throughout the late 1940s, setting up local chapters across the United States, and particularly in the South. She rode trains and buses and met with people in church houses and established little groups here, little groups there, little groups everywhere. Rosa Parks was a member of her local NAACP chapter. She was eventually a leader. She founded her local chapter's youth caucus. She attended three national leadership conferences that Ella Baker ran for the NAACP. And about a month before she did the thing that we all know about on the bus, she spent 2 weeks at the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee being trained in nonviolent direct action and how to operationalize the recent Brown versus Board of Education decision. So we see the newsreel. We see the Rosa Parks mugshot, we see Martin Luther King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But what we don't see are the decades of work before and behind that. So when I teach my course on social movements, of which the civil rights movement is a big part, I ask students, what's the most characteristic image of the civil rights movement? And they say, Rosa Parks' mugshot, the Selma Bridge, the Freedom Rider bus burning, or Martin Luther King on the steps. And then I throw up an image, and it's an image of three people standing and two people sitting on the ramshackle porch of a sharecropper's shack. One of the people is Bob Moses, who was Ella Baker's protege, who was a quiet mathematician philosopher from New York City, who was in graduate school to become a professor and got caught up with Ella Baker, mentored, and it was that patient, house by house, person by person work that 20 years later, Ella Baker sent Bob Moses and other college students back to those local chapters that she had established 15, 20 years before. And ordinary people like E.W. Steptoe and Amesie Moore and Fannie Lou Hamer, who didn't have an eighth grade diploma between the three of them. But they knew about their communities. And so when the time was right, when God was moving, there was a relational infrastructure in place so that when someone like Martin Luther King showed up, there were people who were ready, who were prepared, who had been talking with each other for years, sometimes decades, and would show up when he said, come to Selma, come to Birmingham, come to Washington. And so we remember the big, fancy, flashy, newsreel, famous speeches, you know, Life magazine moments. But what we forget is the hours and hours and hours of ordinary people doing ordinary things. Door to door, house to house, person by person. And for me as a teacher, the fact that a lot of them were college students and seminarians is incredibly exciting. Because younger people, students, sometimes think, well, when I get older, when I grow up, when I'm a real adult, I'll do something. And what the civil rights movement, and we can point to a number of other social movements, including the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, teach us is that it's not tomorrow, it's not when you grow up, it's not someday, it's now. And so, yes, the algorithm is monstrous and, you know, enormous. The market forces of profit, the political forces of power, the incentives are all aligned in the wrong direction. You make money and you get power by doing polarization. It pays. Big bucks and big boats. So we're going to have to start small. simple. It's not sexy. It doesn't make for a good telethon or, you know, photo op. But the work has to start house to house, as old civil rights leaders often say.
That was helpful.
Microphone down front.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize what you've already said, and that is that the civil rights movement, which was is kind of our North Star, really, mm-hmm. but that was a faith-based movement.
Yeah.
And we don't want to forget that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for every sit-in, there are pray-ins. There are fewer photographs, they're harder to find, but they're out there. And the earliest organizers were seminarians and college students. So James Lawson in Nashville is a recently returned veteran studying to be a pastor. Well, he already was a pastor, locally ordained, but he was taking his pastoral training at Vanderbilt Divinity School and started running workshops with other Divinity School students and other college students. And they were among the first to decide, we're going to go down the lunch counter and sit and see what happens. There was a high school youth group in Durham, North Carolina. So at Duke, one of the things that the Center for Reconciliation does is they do an annual event that's called the Durham Pilgrimage of Pain and Hope. It's an educational model developed in South Africa and has been replicated around the world, places like Northern Ireland, where local leaders, pastors, some faculty, over a long weekend will take you around a particular area. So those of us who go to Duke get to do so because of the Duke tobacco money. It's slave money. So you go out to the plantation and see one of the places where the Duke family, bless their hearts, made their money on the backs of Africans and African Americans. You go to the lunch counter in downtown Durham where about a month before the more famous Greensboro College student incident happened, kids in a high school youth group after youth group decided with their youth minister to go down and sit in. These are ordinary people, a lot of them quite young. But it's hard to start small because you're right, it feels so, so big. But places like Westminster can become places of courage, places of charity, where you can, again, start with yourselves, build those skills. And again, it's like that 20 by 20 soccer grid. You have to sit knee to knee or across a little two-top table. You don't get to go, ah, after the first sentence. Each person gets 2 minutes, whatever the artificial constraint is. And you don't get to start with your counterpoint. You have to start with questions. What on earth do you mean by thus and such? Why the heck do you think this? I forget who it was. Somebody said listening, which was, you know, number one answer on the board, survey says. So the paradigm of Christian leadership and political engagement that comes one part out of the civil rights struggle that we just talked about, and another part out of the labor movement in the United States, is basically easy to remember. Listen, learn, lead. Where listening is understood as a form of learning, and learning is understood as a form of leading. But you start with listening. As your mama or your grandmama probably told you, you've got two ears and one mouth. There's a reason. Because you're supposed to use these more than this. All right, this was not how I thought this was going to go, but this is lovely. So we've got about 5 minutes left. Let me just say a couple quick things, and then we can kind of round robin and see what might be left for us to chat about. Good. So this idea of loving neighbor for most of us is pretty accessible and approachable in a context like this. We do well with folks next door, across the street, around the corner. When we're face to face, most of us can generally find our ways to human decency and Christian charity. Oh, you need a garden hose? Sure. It's out back. Let me get it for you. You know, sure, I can watch your kids for 15 minutes while you run to the market because, you know, whatever. We tend to lend a hand, we tend to look out for each other, but under the pressures of polarization, outside of intimacy and proximity like this, things get harder. And our love of neighbor doesn't occur in the friendly confines of face-to-face, person-to-person, nor does it take place in a vacuum or in abstraction. So we need to understand our love of neighbor in the wider circumstances of our common life. And one way to do that is to start with, of course, our Christian commitments. Love of neighbor above all else. And sure, Christian commitments come in all shapes and sizes. There's polarization and divergence and disagreement in the house of God as well as outside. And then we begin to think about what I would call the circumstances of need. Who are our neighbors? How are they suffering? Where is their pain coming from? Love of neighbor isn't one size fits all. If I'm hungry, I need food. If I'm in trouble, I might need a lawyer. Both of those are neighbor love. And then one of which we just talked about now are dynamics of power. And right now, one of the dynamics of power that we're fighting against and wrestling with is the power of our media culture and the political culture that kind of is wed to it. So we start with the command to love neighbor. We then move to an assessment of our neighbors. Again, there's this tradition that comes out of the labor movement and the civil rights movement that has a whole repertoire of assessing, the most basic part of which is the relational meeting, the one-on-one conversation. It's not informal in the sense of, hey, let's just get a coffee and talk about whatever. You know, you're saying, hey, I want to talk about the shooting in the school last week. I want to talk about the Allegheny County Commissioner's whatever they're up to these days. But there's a way of doing that work, that patient work, what Ella Baker would have called spade work. If you're a gardener, tilling the soil, getting the rocks out. And I think that Christians and faith communities are fairly well positioned to do that kind of work. Takes a little training, takes a little organizing to get going, but I think the kinds of people who find their places, their way to places like this, and the kinds of community that we create together in places like this make us very well positioned to do this kind of work. And I'll pause it there since we sort of took an unexpected tour through the civil rights movement. But before we leave out and wrap up, are there lingering questions, open concerns?
As you were wrapping up, I sort of got this image of a plant. Mm-hmm. You know, the plant's going to grow. Mm-hmm. If you nurture the soil, mm-hmm. the nutrients, sun, water, but it's going to grow on its own. Mm-hmm. And that's the way life is. But we have to do the work.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like you outlined so well.
You can throw in the parable of the sower. You know, seed cast in different places has different effect. We ourselves and our communities can become that good soil. And if we can till that good soil in the wider community around a church. All right, it's 10:45. The bell has rung. You are free to go. If you'd like to stay and chat, I'm happy to do so. Thanks for coming, and thanks today especially for a lively conversation. That was not where I expected us to go, but it was lovely to go there. Thank you.